Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite video games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
Syrup.
Syrup is a very good word. Today, in honor of the fact that the Diablo II Resurrected Open Beta was this weekend, as you're listening to this, it has already since passed, and with it looming ever closer in the future to release, which is very, very soon, we figured it would be pertinent to maybe talk about the actual lore and story of Diablo II, possibly in a bit of a recap form. And this is where I lean on my co-host, Matt, who I think his middle name is Diablo, probably. I'm not entirely sure. So where do you think we should begin?
No, it's not, but that's actually, you know, not too far from the truth. I got to give people a recap of the end of Diablo in order for you to understand just how special the story of Diablo 2 really is.
It does pick up like right after the first one, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, it's literally, you know, remember last week when that was going on? Oh, yeah, that's crazy. Okay. Some of this is also lore that they kind of came up with later. Like, they to explain what you just saw, like, when you played the game that wasn't necessarily explained. When you played Diablo, you show up in Tristram and everyone's like, oh, it's you, you're back. Crazy stuff's been going on, man. And there's a guy named Deckard Cain, who's like kind of a village elder, who's like, yeah, I did some research, and apparently the devil's here. Diablo, Lord of Terror himself, he's in this town
Diablo.
Doing bad stuff.
Yeah.
So you playing the character, whatever character you're playing, goes down into Tristram Cathedral, kills Archbishop Lazarus, who turns out to have been behind everything, which is like, yeah, okay. Basically, there's a thing called a soulstone that Diablo is trapped in. Diablo was kept in this cathedral by an ancient order of wizards called the Haradrim. Several hundred years before any of this stuff happened, that's when they built this place. And Lazarus came with the royal family that had come to become, you know, the rulers of Condurus, the kingdom in question, the one that you're in Diablo. Condurus was somewhat of a backward kingdom. It was next to Westmarch, which had been founded earlier. And the king, whose name was Leoric, had started going a little crazy because Archbishop Lazarus literally tried to get Diablo into his body. He was trying to make the king, you know, a vessel for Diablo. The king was, while he wasn't, you know, perfect, he was a good enough man, and he was a strong-willed enough man that he wouldn't let Diablo enter his body, which you know, I don't recommend letting Diablo into your body, just straight up.
I mean, none of the Primeval should really be invited into your body. It's generally a bad idea.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that later. But so Diablo's like got frustrated. He's sort of broke Leoric's brain trying to jam himself in there, and finally was like, "All right, Lazarus, find me somebody more pliable than this guy, because this guy just isn't giving up." So they switch tacks to the youngest son of the royal family, Prince Albrecht. The process of trying to possess the king had driven the king so insane that he began suspecting everybody around him, except the one guy who actually was working with the demon, of working with demons.
So, not to jump ahead real quick, because this ties in directly to some of the first things you deal with in Diablo 3, this is where the idea of the Mad King Leoric comes from.
Mm-hmm. Yep, because he literally was. He went insane because Diablo was trying to possess him, and it broke his brain, and so he began suspecting everybody was working with demons, and only Lazarus could be trusted, because Lazarus was the one who cared about him and was helping him in his head. In reality, Lazarus was the one who was like, "Go get him, Diablo." Lazarus worked for Mephisto, who is another of the three primevals, also coming up in our discussion of Diablo 2. But you go in, playing whichever character you're playing, you kill Lazarus, you deal with Leoric, who at this point has become an undead monstrosity called the Skeleton King, and you find Diablo. Now, you've been spending this entire game looking for Diablo, trying to stop his evil, so you get into a fight almost immediately. If you win, you know, you think, yay, end of the game, except Diablo turns back into Prince Albrecht at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize you've just killed the prince, and now you've got the Soul Stone with Diablo in it. And you're thinking, you know, what do I do with this thing, that's this unholy evil that possessed the prince? Where do I put this thing? And in a decision that shows just how truly great at decision-making you are, you jam it in your own head. And that's the end of the game. That's where Diablo stops. You're like looking at this thing, and then you just yank it on in there.
And like, it should be specified that like the reason or justification that was delivered for this in this terrible, terrible decision making process that heroes always seem to have is that you are attempting to contain Diablo using the essence of your own body and the Soul Stone combined as a prison.
Mm-hmm.
How this makes sense, nobody knows.
This will come up again later as well. However, because this is a decision that other people make in turn. But yeah, you do that. It was later established that the canon ending of Diablo is that the
warrior,
for lack of a better word, the warrior, mm-hmm, is the person who defeated Diablo, and he did it with the aid of the rogue and sorcerer players. And those characters helped him do it. He was Aiden, son, he was the elder son of King Leoric and Queen Ysilla, and the elder brother of Prince Albrecht. And it was implied that he kind of snapped seeing everything that happened to his family and then realizing he'd killed his own brother. So he wasn't entirely of sound mind, and possibly also being influenced by Diablo, because Diablo 2 starts with this guy Marius talking in an insane asylum. And somebody he thinks is the Archangel Tyriel shows up. And he's like, "Oh, Tyriel, it was horrible." And Tyriel's like, "Yeah, yeah, tell me about it."
And before, hold on a second, real quick. Marius, just to give you the sort of like framework, Marius is the narrator for the entirety of Diablo 2. So mm-hmm, when you are hearing things relayed, when you are hearing the story told, when you make your way through Diablo 2, you're hearing it from the perspective of Marius. This is important as we move on, and just something I want to make sure is kept in mind.
Yeah. So the game opens with the cinematic. By the way, if you're playing the new game, you get to see a much, much better cinematic. Much nicer looking. They did the best they could with the limitations of computers in like 1999 when they did the original cinematic. But we obviously have better computers now. That's just what happens. So Marius is in an insane asylum, and the events of the game that you're about to play through, Diablo 2, have already happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he has already done all of this. He's already seen everything that's going on. So figure walks in. Marius thinks it's the Archangel Tyriel. Starts telling, you know, he's like, you know, tell me what, you know, tell me everything. And he starts telling who he thinks is Tyriel everything. And so his story starts with the Rogue Citadel, which was a place basically up in the mountains on the way from Tristram to, I think, I want to say Luc Gallen.
Yeah.
I think so. And he was there. It's pretty obviously an opium den. I mean, they don't actually say this is an opium den, because this was
made during the war on drugs. Saying anything a drug den was bad at the time, folks.
Yeah, but it pretty obviously is an opium den. There's people smoking from weird pipes and, you know, getting all tranced out. It's clearly an opium den. Mm-hmm. And this figure comes in and he's twitching and, you know, he is clearly not well. The sword he's holding, he can barely even carry it. He's like dragging it in front of him. And he, like, when he tries to put it down, his hand starts like shaking, and he has to clamp onto his other hand. And as this is going on, the people around the drug den are basically still doing the things they do because, you know, you don't go to an opium den because you give a rat's butt about what that guy's doing.
Well, not even that. Like, somebody walking in that's completely jaded and strung out is not exactly unheard of. So at this point, like, somebody who's walking in and probably jonesing for a fix, can't hold themselves together. They're used to this at this point. That's kind of just the norm. So they don't think anything of it at first.
Yeah, plus, I mean, the way that the cinematic lingers on one guy in particular, you kind of get the sense he's actually laughing at the Dark Wanderer.
Mm-hmm.
But that turns out to not be a good idea, because as the person's having their fit, the fireplace explodes and demons come pouring out of it, and there's monsters and skeletons attacking everyone. And yeah, Marius isn't sure, is this actually happening? Because, you know, again, we're in an opium den. I'm not 100% positive that I'm seeing what I'm seeing, but if I am, this is bad. And that happens. And then Marius is the only one who survives, probably for, like, you know, I have no idea why Marius survives. Like, there's nothing in this that says he was particularly chosen so much as it was just, he just didn't die.
Well, I think part of it is too, in the cinematic, it's shown that the denizens of the den, basically the folks that are there getting their swerve on or whatever, they're shown trying to fight back against the demons that are being unleashed, right? Because that's what happens. The Dark Wanderer loses that control, and these demons are just ravaging, and they're summoning from their fire imps, and there's undead skeletons somehow that magically get summoned from a fire pit. Don't know how. Hey, whatever generates your cola, I guess. But Marius is the most passive out of all of them, because that's what you're shown, is you're shown shadows of combat and these men trying to fight back and immediately getting cut down. And then the Dark Wanderer winds up getting back control of the entity inside of him, causing all of the demons to disperse, leaving Marius, who has been passive and laying in the corner the entire time, alive and standing there and in this middle of this burning den, just kind of like looking around like, okay, this is a thing. And then the Dark Wanderer just turns around and walks out. And then Marius falls in lockstep behind him, feeling compelled to do so, but having no idea who he is or why he's being compelled to do this. He just goes along with the idea. Why not? Okay, here you go.
And we should make it clear. The Dark Wanderer is the protagonist from the previous game who jammed a big soulstone in his forehead.
Yeah, he's currently fighting Diablo, trying to take over his body.
Yeah, and he also isn't sure what he's doing. Like, at sometimes he says things and they're fairly clearly from Diablo's perspective. And sometimes he doesn't seem to quite be on board with it. But basically, therefore, that's the opening of the game. That moment in the Rogue Citadel. Then the game cuts to your character, whoever you're playing. And the funny thing here is, you're behind the Dark Wanderer the whole time.
Yeah, you're trying to track them down.
Well, the very first part of the game, it isn't 100% clear what you're doing wherever you are, but you're at the Rogue Citadel.
Well, it's not a citadel. It's a camp.
Yeah, well, that's my point. You're at the camp. That's all that's left of the Rogue Citadel. The rogues have, like, decamped to this like, camp because their citadel is full of monsters and demons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, you know, you can't get through. It's not even a question of us letting you through. You just can't get through. The entire area is infested with monsters. And then when you get to the Citadel, Blood Eagle? What is her name?
Blood Raven. And she's Blood Raven is not in the Citadel. She's in the graveyard.
Yeah, but Blood Raven is the reason that the place is like it is. They're like, you know, Blood Raven has like raised all these horrors. You can't get in. And so you spend like the first, I want to say act of the game,
basically cleaning up.
Yeah. You basically spend that time cleaning up the mess that the Dark Wanderer left in his wake, not even on purpose. That's the best part of all this is he didn't even do this on purpose. He just lost control for a second. And you spend an entire act of the game trying to clean up after him.
And let's talk a little bit about what you face in that first act, even in just the first area alone. Now, yes, there are undead monstrosities. There are zombies all over the place. And that's one of the first things that you're going to run into. Then there are these quill beasts, which, again, are very, very common, have existed in all of the Diablo things. And if you played Warcraft, well, you've probably seen them as well. They're sort of the original proto quill boar, if you will. And that's not just it. You find spirits and corrupted trees. In particular, there's Sasquatch that are all over the place. There are the Fallen and Carvers, little imp-like creatures, but not actually imps, that have this sort of like shamanistic society that are all over the place and are riled up because their god Rakanishu is apparently stirred and, you know, doing things. And then it starts getting darker and darker the further you go. Now, Matt talked about Blood Raven. The interesting thing is once you get past the first area, once you clear out the Den of Evil, once you go through the first like core section just around the camp, you get access to more of the areas. And then the reason that the rogues are telling you you can't go here isn't necessarily just because of the evil, but what flavor of evil that waits you as soon as you move into the Stony Fields, which is the second area. The Stony Fields are full of rogues that have fallen under the influence of the Dark Wanderer, or in particular, Diablo. They are corrupted, and they are well-trained and violent. And that is the dangerous thing. And these are not undead. These are just humans that have fallen under the sway of the power of Diablo as he moved through the area. Not even actively Diablo, like trapped inside of the human body as he would. That is a huge, huge, huge inconvenience and very scary for them. And the idea, I think, is not necessarily that you'll die, because death is whatever, and if you come back as a corpse, you're still a corpse and you're easier to deal with. But if you fall under the influence of whatever has infected the rest of them, that becomes even more problematic, because you are, at this point, a skilled character. Whether you are playing as a druid or the assassin or an Amazon or the sorceress or the barbarian, you are, or the necromancer, you contain a whole lot of power. And something like that, falling under sway, well, that's another Blood Raven situation. And that in and of itself is huge and terrible. Go ahead.
Blood Raven is the rogue from the first game.
She is, yes.
If you're when you confront Blood Raven, both Blood Raven and I forget the other one are both the sorcerer and rogue from the previous games are corrupted by Diablo and serve him. And when you confront Blood Raven, Blood Raven is effectively acting as lieutenant for the area, keeping, you know, the place pacified under Diablo's control, keeping things going the way that Diablo wants. Diablo doesn't want anybody coming through on his trail, because he knows from his experiences with Aiden, he knows that mortals can be surprising, and he doesn't want anybody coming like what happened to him in Tristram. He had a host body in Tristram, and then these people showed up and wrecked everything. He doesn't want that this time. This time he's going to ride this body to his destination. So Blood Raven's there, but not just Blood Raven, because once you get past Blood Raven, you find out that it's even worse, because Andariel, one of the seven,
she's a lesser evil.
Lords of Hell. Yeah. She's a lesser evil, but that still makes her one of the Lords of Hell.
Yeah, Andariel, like the Maiden of Anguish, by the way.
Yeah, she is waiting for you. She's basically originally Andariel and her brother Duriel took sides against Diablo, Mephisto, and Baal, the three prime evils, and the three greater evils. My apologies. And helped exile them to the mortal realm. This is something that actually happened well before any of the games. But now they've decided, no, this we won too easily. This was all a setup, and they've pledged themselves to Diablo because they're like, Diablo's up to something. There's a plan going on, and we're gonna join him now so that when he comes back to hell with an army of whatever he's doing, we'll be on the winning side. So Andariel's there waiting for you, and it's in the fight with Andariel that your character shows that they're more than just
human.
Yeah, well, not more than just human, but more than just, somebody who's going to get destroyed by Diablo, that they're actually capable of standing up to the forces of hell, which is important for later in the story.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to know that, like, Andariel, when you face them, you are in, essentially, the monastery. You are in the cloister. That's where you fight her, which is a seat of, essentially a seat of power, a seat of authority in this region, and that's where you fight before moving on to Act 2, in which you find another of the lesser of the evils. But I think I forgot the opening of Act 2. So you wind up going to, what is the actual name of the desert?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Like I said, I think it's Luke Gallain is where you go, I don't remember that the desert is named anything in specific. Hold on, I'm going to look that up while you talk.
So, the different acts of Diablo, like Diablo 1 is all about, finding out what's going on, making sure that you are going through Candoris and cleaning everything up. And then when you get to Act 2, you do go to the town
Arinok. Of Luke Gallain.
It's Arinok Desert. You go to Luke Gallain, and it's another area that is just full of, I'm trying to think how to phrase this. We've talked about this on some of the previous episodes. Like the Act 1 is all about figuring out the Sightless Eye, the rogues, and what's going on there. The second one is all about figuring out what arcanely is going on with things. You're looking for, it is referred to as the Secret of the Vizurai, right? That is the name of this chapter. That is the name of this. And you are essentially going through to figure out what's happening here, following that wave of corruption, but also learning the depths of the corruption of those that wield such deep magic power.
Basically, one of the things about the entire story is that it's sort of like, it takes what we experienced in the original Diablo, and it sort of like starts off like literally hard upon it. Like this is what's happening in the direct aftermath. This is not even days later. And it starts to blow it up in terms of like, its importance and also its scale. Mm-hmm. Like you start off with like this thing happened in this town, but then as your character follows after the Dark Wanderer, you start to run into the actual, I don't know how to like the legacy of what got us to this point keeps showing up. There's a real emphasis on, the people that came before and the actions of the three prime evils, and the fact that it wasn't just Diablo. It was Diablo and his two brothers, Mephisto and Baal. They were all three of them were banished. And it's the primes, the legacy,
right? The biggest of the baddest of them.
The greater evils, the three that were like that ruled hell as a trio. And it's really trying to get the game to like, You start confronting not just the legacy of how they got to Sanctuary in the first place, but you're actually ultimately, the story is about the very creation of Sanctuary. You go, when you're in Act 2, you're looking for the tomb of Tal Rasha. And Tal Rasha was a member of the Haradrim, the order that Deckard Cain was in. And you're searching for the tomb of Tal Rasha because that's where you believe the Dark Wanderer is going. And you're right, but he gets there before you. And he can't, the funny thing is that we find out one of the reasons that Marius is involved in this whole thing in the first place, one of the reasons that Diablo is allowing him to continue following, is that Diablo can't take the Soul Stone out of Tal'Rasha's body. He can't remove it. Ultimately, Marius is the one who removes the Soul Stone from Tal'Rasha's body. And in that process, Tyriel shows up. You end up fighting Duriel, the brother of Andariel, one of the other lesser evils. Duriel confronts you inside the tomb of Tal'Rasha while the Dark Wanderer, you know, leaves, along with Baal. He's freed Baal from Tal'Rasha's body. This is, I told you before, we'd talk about people getting the idea of jamming soul stones into themselves.
Yeah, it's not the first time.
This is actually the first time with Tal'Rasha. Back when they were originally hunting for the three greater evils, they'd confined one underneath the city of Karast, the Lord of Hatred, Mephisto. When they were confronting Baal, the Lord of Destruction, he destroyed his soul stone that they were trying to put him in because he's the Lord of Destruction. He does that kind of thing. But they weren't willing to let it go. They still managed to batter him into submission, and then they put him into the broken soul stone and then put that into Tal'Rasha. This was Tal'Rasha's idea, by the way. They didn't just grab Tal'Rasha and do this. Tal'Rasha was like, no, we're not letting this go. We can use a mortal host to contain the essence of the demon. Just put him in me and I'll fight him forever. I'll be in here in his body. He'll be here in my body. We'll be entombed in here and we'll fight forever. And he'll never be able to escape. It didn't actually work out that well for Tal'Rasha because over the centuries, he eventually lost the battle with Baal, but Baal was still contained within his body. And that's important later too, because, well, we'll get into that. But when you get there, Baal has left with Diablo. Duriel fights you, and Tyriel charges Marius. Tyriel's the guy, the Archangel of Justice, who actually created the Haradrim originally. He charges Marius with taking the Soul Stone to hell to destroy it. Because that will prevent Baal from continuing on, supposedly. So then you go into Act 3. Now, Act 2, is, as Joe pointed out, is, you know, you're searching for the Tomb of Tal'Rasha. You're trying to figure out what's going on with the Haradrim and their ancient magical secrets. Act 1 was the whole confrontation with Andariel. You know, how is it that the sisters have been corrupted? The Sisters of Sightless Eye have been corrupted. And Act 3 sort of like, it says, you remember the corruption you saw in Act 1? Yeah, about that.
So Act 3 is called the Infernal Gate, and it's aptly named because of what winds up happening, I think, here. But you wind up, one of the things I think should also be kind of brought up is, as you're moving between the acts, you as the player, even though you're following behind the Dark Wanderer, you're helping reestablish trade routes and communication between the sections and pockets of humanity, because that's one of the things that is repeated a theme throughout all of the acts that you move to. In Act 1, the rogue encampment is completely cut off from the rest of the world. They're isolated. In Act 2, it's the same thing in Lut Galain. And in Act 3, it's the same thing as you make your way into, I believe the town is Karast.
Yeah, the Temple of Karast is where you're ultimately heading, yeah.
Yeah,
Karast is a temple city. Essentially, it's like one of two capitals of, at that time, the Khajistan Empire. It's Karast is the holy city of the High Council of Zakharum.
Yeah. And you're the very first thing that you're tasked with doing here is, again, magical properties are sort of like a keystone here. But the Docktown has a magical barrier that kind of protects it from the jungle encroaching in. And this is kind of important because the jungle, even without any sort of dark influence, is an incredibly dangerous place filled with poisonous plants and creatures and tiny little demonic guys that will, you know, stack up on top of each other and go after you and try to kill you. And so you, need, the first thing you need to do is try to help them figure out why is the barrier weakening, and then go after it and try to fix it. Basically, and then you have to get what's called a sacred blade. I think it's the Skatsimi blade, I think, or something like that. Basically, it's used in a ritual casting in order to basically make the seal work. You do this, but this is a side diversion. This is intentional. This is something to keep you busy and occupied because, again, as Matt pointed out, you're trying to go to the main temple of Karast. It is where you are supposed to be heading, but you're too busy dealing with other minor things that have immediate threat because otherwise you'd be abandoning humanity to the ravages of whatever horrors that are out there.
Yeah, and basically, when the original Haradrim were hunting the three greater evils, they caught Mephisto first. Talarasha, who was the most powerful among them, was like, well, I'm kind of a member of this new religion called Zakharum, and those guys are really, they're completely incorruptible. They don't have any worldly things. They hang out in this city, Travancol. We'll confine him under that, and we'll leave the Soul Stone there underneath the Temple of Light within Travancol, and we'll go forth to hunt down the other two. Then we'll obviously we'll be coming back, and then we'll figure out, you know, like a more secure containment for him. That didn't work out because Talrasha ended up, you know, literally with Baal living inside his corpse. By that point, after they confined Baal, Talrasha wasn't in charge anymore. So the bunch of the ones that were left when they caught up to Diablo were like, let's just stick him here. Those Zakharum dudes, we left one of them with the Zakharum dudes. We'll set up a monastery for our order here. And that's where they kept Diablo. That was in Tristram. So you can see how far they went. If you look at the map of Sanctuary, they started off doing this stuff in Travancol. Then they went across the sea to the Anorak Desert and Lut Golain, and that's where they confined Baal. And finally, they went up into the mountains and confined Diablo. So there's this, you can kind of see the arc of their travel.
Which we are now moving backwards through.
Yeah, you're literally retracing the steps in the opposite direction. When you get to Travancol, which is across a bridge, it's like there's a causeway between Travancol and Karast proper. Travancol is kind of like a city within a city or a city like adjacent to a city. When you get there, though, you're basically the whole emphasis of this story is about people's perceptions of things versus the reality of them. In that, you know, especially if you're playing a paladin, this really hits home. But the Church of Zakharum, which is like kind of the holy church of this world, it's the major monolithic religion of the world, has been infiltrated by Mephisto over his centuries of imprisonment within Travancol. He's managed to use the Soul Stone to reach out and corrupt the minds of various members of the Order of Zakharum. One of them was Archbishop Lazarus. So Lazarus initially, when you do Diablo, the original Diablo, it's implied that, you know, Diablo must have corrupted Lazarus first. But he wasn't. Lazarus wasn't corrupted by Diablo. Lazarus came to Tristram to find Diablo on the behest of the Church of Zakharum, specifically the thing living underneath it.
Quick interruption, and I don't think we've mentioned this. We've talked about it on previous episodes, but I also think talking about the Soul Stones just a little bit.
Good point.
We probably should have done this a little bit earlier. But the Soul Stones were originally created by the Archangel Tyriel, with the express goal of trying to contain the three primevals when they were, quote-unquote, exiled into Sanctuary.
Yeah, but, which was the... We're going to also point out the whole exile thing. That was a gambit.
It was.
Yeah, but go ahead.
The important thing that I think needs to be stated here is that the Soul Stones themselves were things that were crafted from shards of the World Stone itself. Now, that is important for a lot of reasons. One, because the goal of the demons in general, and particularly the primevals, is to get to the World Stone and use it, right? The World Stone, otherwise known as the Eye of Anu, or the Heart of Creation, or the Heart of the World, is what made Sanctuary. It is what Sanctuary, the world that we are playing in, the world that we inhabit, moves completely around. It's what allows it to become permanent. That is incredibly powerful. It is an incredibly powerful item, an order of magnitude at a cosmic level. So you're trapping these beings that are also essentially made from the same primordial stuff of the universe into these items with the hope of containing them. But the problem is the world stone is connected, well, to the world. And thinking short-term, sure, it took him out of the fight for a certain amount of time, but Mephisto really is sort of like, we've seen people jam soul stones into them, but this is a perfect example of why it wasn't a great idea. Because they weren't completely cut off, even with an unbroken soul stone. They weren't completely cut off from the entirety of the world around them. They still had a connection to it that over time, and these are eternal beings, could learn to exploit and to start to express their wishes and exert their sort of influence on everything around them, which again leads to that sort of corruption. It leads to the corruption of the Zakharum faith. It leads to the corruption of the Temple of Light. It is an important thing to note that, again, contained does not mean that they could not influence the world around them. And that is a big, big deal. And Mephisto, well, he's probably the best out of all of them is when it comes to that subtle manipulation.
Yeah, as the Lord of Hatred, Mephisto is uniquely qualified to corrupt the people around him. He doesn't, it should be pointed out that the head of the Church of Zakharum is the Quahagan, who's kind of like the great patriarch of the faith. And at this moment, when you are tracking after the
Dark Wanderer.
You're basically, one of the things is you actually end up ultimately meeting Sanakur, who is the Quahagan. And he's literally the host of Mephisto. Because over time, the ritual, the purpose of the Quahagan was twisted, and they kept using the Soul Stone directly.
Yep.
And they were basically the various, when Baal and Diablo get there, they free Mephisto from his Soul Stone, and he possesses Sanakur's body. And what's really messed up, and this is something that will again also come up, is Mephisto is left behind to guard the portal to hell that Baal and Diablo make use of.
And not only
when you get there, you're effectively too late.
Go ahead. I was going to say not only that though, but also to waylay us, right? To waylay anybody that would follow after, not just guard the portal, but like this is where the plague that is creeping through the jungle, that is creeping through the city and everything around it, this is where it's originating. These are why we have these side things to deal with, is because Mephisto's back and you is sitting there manipulating and doing this, like to the point where I think one of the and I'm remembering this, I haven't played through Act 3 in a very, very long time, but I remember having to go and find a specific item, which I think was a reference to the Book of the Dead, but it was like the Black Book from the temples, in order to figure out, one, what was going on, two, what the source of the plague was, and three, what the end goal of, at this point, Diablo and Baal actually was.
Yeah, and so basically, when you get, like Joe mentioned, you get to Caress Docks, and there's a lot of stuff you have to do because the place is in shambles. They've effectively, the thing about following the Dark Wanderers, the whole time you're doing it, you're basically forced to deal with all the chaos that's come up in his wake. There's the Scotsimi Blade and so forth. The thing that you're trying to do is essentially not just restore order, but you have to figure out what's going on. What do they want? Why are they even doing this? The Black Book you're talking about is from an alchemist. I want to say Alcar.
Anyway, I think Alcar is correct.
And you get the Travancore and you follow it up and you find out that, you know, you try to prevent the primevals from reuniting, but again, you're too late. It, just like you've been too late pretty much this whole time, because you're following them, and you're following them as, it's sort of like, I want you to imagine you're chasing someone through a china shop, and they can knock all the shelves over and drop the china on your head.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to try and reestablish order just to get through. Like, you can't leave, you couldn't leave harassed in chaos and move forward, not just because you're a representative of humanity, because you literally would never get anywhere. So when you get to Travancore, when you defeat Sanakura the Quahagan and you know, destroy Mephisto, or seem to at least, he'll of course, you know, come back later. You find the portal they've opened to the Burning Hells, and you're like, I don't, like, okay, was all this just to get back? Like, were they just trying to get back to the Hells? Is that everything? Should I just let them go? And Tyrael shows up and is like, oh no, 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 no. This is very bad. We have to stop them, because if they manage to succeed, they're gonna go for the World Stone. And if they get it, this entire world is effectively going to be, you know, it's going to fall into the control of the Lords of Hell. And that means we're all going to die. They're going to destroy heaven, and everything is going to be ruled by evil forever. So you need to go through and kill Diablo and destroy his soul stone, as well as Mephisto's soul stone that you now have, because A, putting them in soul stones was a terrible idea, as Joe pointed out earlier. Tyrael's like, yeah, this did not work out the way I wanted at all. And more importantly, the whole point of this is that they want to get to the World Stone, and they have to be stopped, because if the three of them go to the World Stone combined, their power is such that nothing could possibly stop them. And if they get to the World Stone, it will be a very, very bad thing. So you go into Hell to do what Marius was supposed to do, because Marius doesn't do it. Marius does not go to Hell. Your characters take the Soul Stone from Mephisto, and you go after Diablo in Hell to find and take his Soul Stone away from him and destroy it. That's Act 4 is not complicated in that way.
No, it's really not. Because, I mean, aside from the fact that you start Act 4 in Pandemonium Fortress, which,
mm-hmm.
If you're not familiar with it, Pandemonium, as Deckard Cain points it out, is the last bastion of light in the Burning Hells. It is a fortress that is set to basically act as the base of operations for the angels in their eternal battle with the demons of Hell itself. It is interesting because your player has essentially at this point traveled to a place that really the angels didn't want the Nephilim or humans to really go to, but they don't really have a choice either.
Yeah, at this point, the angels are sort of like on the back foot here. Tyrael's now in effectively in charge, and they're just kind of having to do what he says. As an archangel, they have to listen to him. He's you know, the archangel of justice. So stuff is going on. You're sent in. Effectively, you're going to go and defeat Diablo, get his soul stone, and use both the Hellforge in the Pandemonium Fortress to destroy the soul stones, which should prevent Diablo and Baal from Diablo and Mephisto from returning to Sanctuary. Because, like, remember when I told you before that the whole bit where they got exiled was a gambit? It was always about Sanctuary. It was always about the World Stone and the mortal beings of Sanctuary. We're going to have to talk about this at least a little bit. So, Sanctuary exists because an angel and a demon fell in love and didn't want to fight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They were still an angel and a demon, so their personalities are pretty important. The angel was... Oh, bloody heck, I can't remember his name. I know the demon was Lilith, and I cannot remember the name.
Linarius.
Linarius, thank you. Inarius, not Linarius. Yeah. Linarius. Mm-hmm. Inarius was the angel. Lilith was the demon. Lilith was the daughter of Mephisto, the Lord of Hatred. She was still a demon. She just thought that the entire eternal conflict was ridiculous and there was no point to it. When she met Inarius, she basically captured him and was going to kill him, but he started ranting and raving about the whole war being pointless, about how it could never end, about how it was sickening that they were trapped in this continuous, endless battle, which she agreed. She didn't like the whole point of the war was stupid because they never won it. There's no winner to this. It just keeps fighting forever.
Yeah, the war was literally set up to be eternal because the sides were so evenly matched.
Yeah, and the Pandemonium Fortress, the angels had it, then the demons took it, then the angels took it back, and just kept going and going. Both sides were fighting over this thing called the Eye of Anu. And so Inarius and Lilith came up with a plan. They found others in heaven and hell who agreed with them that the eternal conflict was stupid. And they struck. They invaded the Pandemonium Fortress, and they stole the relic that it was guarding initially. That relic was the World Stone, the Eye of Anu. Anu being one of the original primordial being who split itself into two, that tore itself into the pure radiant being and Anu the Diamond Warrior, and the foul, corrupt, you know, literally everything vicious and vile in existence, Tathamet. And Tathamet was an enormous demonic dragon with seven heads. When the Diamond Warrior Anu and Tathamet struck against each other, they were so equally matched that they destroyed each other. All that remained of Anu was his spine. The giant diamond arch,
which is
that
effectively became heaven, yeah, right?
It became the root of heaven. It's where all the angels come from. They're literally born out of its radiance. The song that it gives off, the music of the spheres, like it comes from that, and that's where all the angels come from. The demons, the original seven demons, the prime and the greater and lesser evils, are the heads of Tathamet. Mm-hmm. That when the dragon was killed, the heads ripped themselves free and became the various greater evils. So that's the origin of all existence. When they broke into the Pandemonium Fortress, the only relic of the original Anu is the Eye of Anu. This thing, this World Stone, had been used before, but when people would take the fortress, they'd attempt to use it. The problem was it was always like a demon trying to use it or an angel trying to use it. This time, together, a demon and an angel used it. And they used it to create a place where they could hide from the eternal conflict. And that was Sanctuary. Sanctuary is named that because it is a sanctuary for them.
And for those that were like-minded, right? Like for the exactly. Other demons and angels that were looking to escape the confines of the eternal conflict. But
we got to go into like one more thing.
Yep.
Lilith was never content to just hide out. That was never her goal. Because Lilith knew the origin of the universe. She knew where the angels and demons came from. They all did. They were aware of where they came from. They knew that they came from the fight of the Diamond Warrior and Tathamet. They knew that Tathamet and the Diamond Warrior were two halves of one being that tore itself apart, that wanted to purify itself of all foul things, and in so doing created them. They knew that before all that, there was Anu. The being that was both at once, the being that could make choices and decisions about its existence, the being that chose to divide itself, and the Eye of Anu was a remnant of it. Working together, they could use it to create Sanctuary, which was the first time the World Stone had been used to create a permanent world. Also working together, they could reunite power.
Yeah, the essences of Anu.
And they did it in the most, you know, basic way one can do that kind of thing. They got down. And in getting down, they had children, because that happens when you get down. You know, they made babies. And those babies contained within them both angelic and demonic essence. They could pick. They could make a choice. Angels and demons don't really have a choice about being what they are. Because what they are is kind of like, it's preordained from the act of their genesis. They don't have free will. I mean, they can do things, they can make decisions, but they always make those decisions based on their essence. But the children of the angels and demons born into Sanctuary, which were called the Nephilim, were incredibly powerful. And they were neither angel nor demon. They could make their own decisions. The first was Linarion, the son of Inarius and Lilith. He would eventually be known as Rathma, and we're not really going to talk about him too much, but he's ultimately
responsible.
We talked
about it on previous episodes.
Yeah. He's ultimately responsible for the Order of Necromancers. Another was Bul-Kathos. We don't know where Bul-Kathos comes from. We don't know his ancestry, but Bul-Kathos was an incredibly powerful Nephilim. He had a brother named Fiacla-Giar, and Fiacla-Giar and Bul-Kathos both created their own kingdoms out in the world.
Bul-Kathos, and Druids respectively,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. Bulcathos's descendants chose to protect Mount Ariat, which was where the Worldstone was. The Worldstone was inside the mountain, and it was the secret of the barbarians that they were forever protecting it. The Druids took a different tack, and while the barbarians stuck around the Worldstone protecting it, the Druids would go out into the world and attempt to restore the natural balance whenever possible, literally to bring nature to the world. Another of the Nephilim was Isu. And Isu is important because Isu is essentially where sorcery as we understand it comes to Sanctuary. It was Isu who discovered those secrets. It was Isu who learned how to use elemental magics. The Zan Isu order of mages that would ultimately be involved in the Mage Wars comes from Isu. Isu is the original source of, oh, this is how to be a wizard. This is how to be a sorcerer. This is how to do magic. That comes from Isu. So that's all part of what's happening now. Diablo and Mephisto and Baal want to go to Mount Ariat and use the Worldstone. Because once they corrupt the Worldstone, they can corrupt the entire world. And in so doing, use the mortal souls as an inexhaustible army of corrupted beings to destroy the heavens once and for all. They can finally get the upper hand. Which is sort of what Lilith wanted, but not. When we do a Diablo 3 and Diablo 4 story, we'll probably talk more about that. But you go through, you find and fight Diablo, you kill him, you take his soul stone, and you take Mephisto's soul stone to the Hellforge. But since Marius didn't go to hell with you, he didn't bring Baal's soul stone with him. You don't get there. Mm-hmm. Like you don't get to destroy it. The game ends and you see the final cinematic where Marius confesses to Tyrael that he was too weak to enter and he was afraid and the soul stone was affecting him. So he's like, I didn't go here. You take it. You take the soul stone, Tyrael, and you can take it to the Pandemonium Fortress and destroy it. And that's where you find out it wasn't Tyrael Marius has been talking to this whole time. It was Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Because Baal's still inside Talrasha's body. He's using it. He's riding around in it. And this is something we found out kind of retroactively by fighting Sonakur. When you fight Mephisto in the body of Sonakur, he's twisted it to look like himself, but it's still Sonakur's body. That's the thing about these host bodies. They can make them look like themselves, but they're still the original host. So Baal now kills Marius. He now has his soul stone. So he's finally completely united and whole. And he's now going to, whilst the heroes are off doing what they're doing, because remember, you went to hell to fight Diablo and, destroy his and Mephisto's soul stones. Literally, the epilogue of the game, the Act 4 epilogue, is happening while you're doing that.
Yeah.
It's not after everything's wrapped up. It's literally, Marius didn't go in. He went to the insane asylum. He's, like, rambling on to Baal the whole time you're fighting Diablo. So Baal then goes, he now knows where the Worldstone is. And he marches his literally an army of demons that he has brought with him.
Yeah, the opening cinematic is him on his palanquin being born to the mountain.
And for all that they are incredible warriors, they're strong, they're fierce, they could have stood up against pretty much any mortal army. The army of demons cuts its way through to the Worldstone. And you spend Act 5, which is the expansion Diablo 2 Lord of Destruction, you spend it basically trying to catch up with Baal, much as you once tried to catch up with Diablo. And when you get to Pandemonium Fortress after you defeat Diablo, Tyrael sends you to Ariat directly.
Yeah.
Doesn't mess around. He's like, no, you got to go to Ariat right now.
Yeah, he dumps you into Hoggoroth.
Yeah. And you spend you basically spend this entire game, all of Diablo 2, you are on the back foot. You are never in a position where you're ahead of what they're planning. Their plan is centuries old. they have been working to this moment for literal eons. And when you finally get on their trail, you just never get a chance to get ahead of them because they were ready for this. This is what their plan was all along. Even when you fight Diablo and destroy him, it doesn't end the plan because he freed Baal. And so even though he knew he might get fought by mortals again, he deliberately lures you into hell to fight him to give Baal the time he needed to get to Ariat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all, you finally get to Ariat, you confront Baal, but it's too late. He has used his essence on the World Stone through the Soul Stone that he's been carrying. The reason he needed the Soul Stone in the first place, it wasn't just so he could remain on Sanctuary.
Remember when we talked about how using a shard of the World Stone was a really bad idea to contain an evil of that magnitude? Yeah. Yeah, this is so pretty much a definition of that.
He uses that Soul Stone to help him corrupt the World Stone. And the World Stone now, it's the demonic essence is going to creep out into the world that it made. And in so doing, all the mortals of that world will be, you know, bound. They'll be transformed into like beings of hell and they'll be used in the war. It'll be like suddenly that the hosts of hell will now suddenly have an army the size of the entire population of Sanctuary to just throw at heaven. And then when the angels get through that, then they'll be attacked by the hosts of hell and they won't be able to stand up to it. So with that happening, and you defeat Baal, but now you're like, okay, this is happening. What do we do? Tyrael does the only thing he can think to do. He destroys the World Stone.
Yep.
And that keeps the corruption from spreading, you know, into everything in the entirety of Sanctuary. It also, if you know anything about Diablo Immortal, it also starts the events of Diablo Immortal where literally the rain of fragments of the World Stone sheds across the entire world, and everywhere they land, they're now corrupted and evil monsters are rising from them and trying to use them to their own advantage.
But not only that, but it also heralds something that was in the events of Diablo history. The World Stone was also used to lock away sort of the nascent power of the Nephilim to keep Nephilim from happening, to turn them into humans, right?
Because when Inarius confronted Lilith, like, you know, we had these children and now they're the angels and demons who serve us are afraid of them. And the various angels and demons vote to kill their offspring. Lilith won't let them. And she actually kills her own followers. She kills the demons and angels that came to Sanctuary to protect the Nephilim. And she explains, no, they're going to be how we win. This is going to be how the eternal conflict ends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to be our servants. We're going to conquer both heaven and hell, and the war will be over. That's what you wanted. You wanted the war to be over. I've given it to you. I gave you a son who will help, you know, these children will be the power that reunites the cosmos. I've done it. I've won the war. All we have to do is go on with this. He used the power of the World Stone to banish her because he couldn't bring himself to kill her, but he realized he'd been tricked. He used the power of the World Stone to banish her, and then he suppressed their powers. Beings that already had them, like that had already been born and had raised up to their full power, he couldn't do much about them because their power was inherently equal to that of the World Stone. Because like the World Stone, they combined both powers within themselves. But everybody being born to them, all the children and grandchildren and so forth became humans without that massive cosmic power. But the seed of it was locked in, and we find out after the World Stone is destroyed by Tyrael that it has effects on Sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
But that's Diablo 3's story, which we're not going to go too much into right now. But yeah, that's the interesting thing about the premise of this game, that the story of this game from the beginning is that this entire plan has been in operation for centuries. And you are literally the absolute last hope anybody has to stop it. Is this, you know, when you start the game, you're playing a character who is like, wow, I want to get through this pass, but it's completely clogged by demons. I guess I better do something about that. By the end of the game, you are literally deciding the fate of worlds. And it's like, how did I get here? Why is this all on my shoulders? All right, because Marius is a little whiner and nobody wants to help me. So I guess we're going to have to do it ourselves. It's really a fascinating, it's almost like an object lesson in how to escalate a story in a game, because it really does climb up from, you know, hey, there's this rogue monastery that's, you know, the Sisterhood of the Sightless Eye. They're having problems. I better deal with it. To the fate of the entire cosmos is at stake. We cannot allow Baal to corrupt the World Stone, or the eternal conflict will be ended in their army of blood. And you're like, okay, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's Diablo 2 also represents, we talk about this, we've talked about this before, we've talked about this on the regular podcast. Diablo 2 represents a turning point in action RPGs where, yeah, the story is very present here. It's, yes, at its core, a hack and slash game where you go through and just upgrade loot and basically beat bosses and so turn them into loot pinatas. But there's a story, there's cinematics in between, there's a purpose to the things you are doing. And in essence, the way that I refer to Diablo 1, if Diablo 1 is a dungeon crawl, a traditional like tabletop dungeon crawl, which it is, Diablo 2 is the world around that dungeon that you're diving into. And it is what happens when your campaign goes from lower power level to higher power level, and it very much embodies that. The stakes get higher the further you go. You find out more things that make you go, oh no. And you're progressively getting more powerful as you try to deal with these things until you finally get to the end point. And Diablo is unique in that regard as far as action RPGs, and why it is Diablo 2 is often hailed as sort of like the grandfather of the genre at this point, because it set all these things in motion to be part of that genre. It is the first time we had a story this kind of cohesive. And you can go back, and there are plenty of books that you can read. The Sin War trilogy is a really great place to understand a lot of sort of the events that lead up to it. The Book of Deckard Cain has a lot of information in there. There's a ton of resources out there that I would recommend going into, because everything that happens in those books directly correlates to Diablo 2. And then Diablo 2 sets into motion the events that happen in Diablo Immortal and also Diablo 3, and then by extension moving into Diablo 4. Everything stays linked together, and it is a rarity that you see action RPGs that spend that much time linking the story together. And yes, gaps have been filled in over time. That's sort of the nature of like Matt pointed out, like the limitation of storytelling in technology at that time versus now. And with Diablo Resurrected, it is an exciting time to be able to re-experience all of that in glorious redefined graphics, but also redefined audio, where the music and the story and the voice acting are presented in such a way that, you know, maybe you missed it the first time around, maybe you missed it when you played it again a few years later, but everything is front and center and presented in a very unique and well redefined way.
Another thing, like to go upon what Joe just said, in a real way, Diablo 2 is like, it basically said, it answers a question I don't think anybody really was asking, but it manages to do so well that people are like, yeah, this is great. In that the events of Diablo are messed up. Mm-hmm. Like the game is weird and bad. Not bad.
It's grimdark.
Yeah. And Diablo 2 is, how did we get a world where this could happen? It is literally like, well, here's the world that made that possible. Here's how you could have that happen.
And then Diablo 3 is what happens in 25 years in the aftermath of that.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, if the Pope was revealed to be like, you know, literally inhabited by a demon, it's like what? So yeah, there's a lot. One of the things I like about the Diablo games is that sense of, you know, you always start off as a relatively normal person. Like I don't want to say minor, but your character, you start at level 1, you are barely capable of killing a few skeletons. And by the end of the game, you're practically a god. That's mm-hmm. happened, you know, both in Diablo 2 and Diablo 3, and to a lesser degree in Diablo. The original Diablo isn't quite as extravagant, but that's, it has the whole, you know, we're trying to stop this thing from happening aspect. There's just, it's fascinating for how the lore exists to basically support the gameplay modes, but also the gameplay modes are rooted in the lore.
Yep.
And how they work. It is really an interesting game to play. And you know, I feel really kind of a lot of you people who've never played it are going to get a chance to, and it's going to be really fun for you because it's going to be working. And yeah, I think this is really cool. So
I look forward to all of you experiencing the same thing I did, which is going through all of your mice and burning out. Well, you can't burn out CDs anymore, but going through a whole series of mice because, well, that's what happened. But Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And if you do have questions for this podcast or any of the other podcasts that we do, be sure to send them into podcast@BlizzardWatch.com or into one of our various channels on our Discord, and we'll be more than happy to work them in as we have time. And as a final thought, all of us at Blizzard Watch continue to stand with the employees of Activision Blizzard in demanding change for a better tomorrow and to have their demands met for a safe working environment.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.